Summit County Council yesterday discussed energy with Rocky Mountain Power executives and met for a couple of hours with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. In the studio with details, I have County Council Member Glenn Wright. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's talk about the joint meeting with Snyderville Planning. Got into some philosophical issues. The discussion about setting up a mixed-use zone in the Snyderville Basin. As you see it, what's the purpose of this zone?
I think this may be one of the most impactful things the council and the planning commission works on over the next year. Developing mixed-use areas within the Snyderville Basin will allow us to concentrate growth into compact communities where hopefully we can design communities where people can get a lot of their own daily needs within walking or bicycling distance and connect to the larger transportation system that we have for the western part of the, and actually the whole part of the county now, if we include South Summit.
Yeah. So when you talk about impactful, I mean, how so? With many impacts coming or just because of the...
I think it's an important development to improve the future quality of life in Summit County. We're facing enormous growth demands on the county, and if we allow it to sprawl, no one's going to like it. We need to concentrate the growth in the places that can accommodate it and really try to create communities where people can get a lot of their daily business done without hopping into a car and driving all over the county.
Is this being done specifically for like the Klein-Dolly parcel?
That'll be included in one of the development areas, yes. Not specifically for Klein-Dolly, but there are several nodes around the county that will be identified as potential mixed-use areas.
And we're talking more of the dense areas, really, right? More
yes.
Affordable housing?
Yeah, that is correct. In more of the dense areas.
And with this new zone, you'd still have to see if it passes Section 2.3. That is, does it offer a compelling public benefit that would justify additional density? As you remarked, does this mean that every applicant comes in with a let's make a deal?
Yeah. My personal opinion is I think we should make this, the zones themselves more prescriptive and kind of lay out the criteria that we want to see. Right now, it's pretty much an open-ended question. What can we get out of a developer? I'd like to see some hard criteria in certain areas. Chris and Doug have made some interesting progress on developing some ratios for affordable housing that could increase densities. I don't know if those are going to be the final numbers, but that's part of the effort I'd like to see finalized in the mixed-use zones.
So we're not talking about doing away with Section 2.3.
No.
That stays.
No, we're talking about making really more precise criteria within this mixed-use zoning.
You're right. And so for you, I mean, because the language says compelling and countervailing, I mean, what does that mean to you? What becomes compelling?
Well, I'll talk about one of my, wants in this particular effort. Last year, we set a resolution to have some fairly aggressive climate change goals and carbon footprint goals. I think that has to be part of any development. An example that we've talked about recently is Lincoln Station development, which is kind of a model for some of the things we're talking about here. And there, the potential is to go from 1 to 78 units. My view on that is if those additional units are not carbon neutral, once we get to 100% renewable energy, then that's not a kind of countervailing interest for the county.
Mm-hmm. Talking about Lincoln Station, you said that the project should have heat pumps, and you felt so strongly about it that it would be a deal killer if it didn't. So what's a heat pump?
A heat pump is really an air conditioning system that works in two directions. Cools in the summer, heats in the winter. And really, if you put your hand out by the condenser of an air conditioner, if you have a window air conditioner, put it on the outside, you'll feel heat coming out in the summer. Think of it as just turning that around in the winter. And by running that on electricity rather than some other kind of carbon-based fuel, as we get to 100% renewable energy, those buildings will, from a building footprint standpoint, become carbon neutral.
So when we talk about trying to create affordable housing and yet we're requiring them to have something that we don't require for other developments, I mean, is that, that just does, it seems counterintuitive there.
We can have more than one goal, I think, for the county. You know, affordable housing and climate change are two very compelling goals the county has. And I don't see them as necessarily being working against each other. Had some discussions during our we had that session with Berkshire Hathaway before our session, and I was talking to their head of electrification. They have contractors who will work with developers to develop the most efficient, both from an energy and economic standpoint, available.
Well, that's what's key, though, in the whole affordable housing thing is
absolutely.
Economic.
And by all accounts, these can be made economically viable.
So do you want this, when we talk about heat pumps, as a requirement or an incentive in the building code?
My mind is it should be a requirement. I'm only one person. You know, we have a lot of further discussions to have on this. Yeah, that's my particular issue. If you listen to some of the other discussions we had last night, for instance, you know, Roger talked about making sure we have good connections to transit. Doug talked about the problems with water runoff and how to address those issues. Kim and Chris talked about more general issues on how to, you know, make these communities really vibrant and places that we want people want to visit.
Yeah. So are we talking about these incentives or requirements just in these new mixed-use developments, or would this be, you know, county building-wide, you know, for
at
everything?
At this point, just in this for a rezoning effort, because some of the things that we will probably require in the rezoning effort, because of legislative limitations we have, we can't necessarily put in the building code. If someone wants a rezone, it is somewhat of a let's make a deal argument. You can agree to this, or you can have the 1-to-20 zoning that is on your property.
Yeah, talk about some of the other controlling some other features, like heated driveways.
We haven't really addressed that yet. I certainly think that's something we should be looking at.
But again,
in the future,
and
yes,
that's not part of this whole rezone.
It's not, but if we make the requirement general enough in terms of carbon footprint for a rezone, that would pretty much eliminate heated driveways. Or if you were to put those in, it would have to be offset by some massive amount of renewable energy. So yeah, actually, that hadn't come up as. Thank you, Leslie. Something we should be talking about.
Well, as Roger Armstrong noted, two Christmas trees you can see from space. So
yes.
I mean, do we need to do some controlling there?
Yes. Light, light escaping from properties is something that we've seen a big problem with, particularly with the Hyatt property along 224. I think that was a surprise at how bright that was. So I think we're going to have to do some serious thinking about that. And I would hope you won't ask me any more technical information on that, because I am completely ignorant of light trespass. Next time you get Doug in here, ask Doug about that. He seems to be pretty knowledgeable of it.
All right. So in terms of some of the other comments that were made in terms of stretching the transit system to serve people in some of these newer areas, how do we do that?
Well, I think as we're building out the spine of the system, the best way we think right now is to drive some type of system from neighborhoods to get into the spine. And if you look at some of the proposals we were looking at for future bus rapid transit system, connecting to that in several places from our diverse neighborhoods is really the way to go. We have to make it convenient for people to get to transit.
And what about senior housing? I know you've had some requests for some projects there. Does that, what is what we put into these mixed-use projects?
Yes, it could happen. Yeah, absolutely. Senior housing, I think, is an important issue for the community. As the, one of the members on the council who may be facing it faster than the rest of my council mates, I think it's a significant issue.
Yeah. In terms of, again, when you talk about a deal maker, I mean, does that then become one of those community benefits? Or
It could be a community benefit. You know, you have to judge that when someone comes up with a plan. But that, that could certainly be a community benefit.
All right. Let's see. As you mentioned, you met with some executives from Berkshire Hathaway. And what did you walk away with from that?
Well, I think the major interest there was for Berkshire Hathaway to get a feeling for what we're doing here. The communication was a lot in their direction. I did talk to a couple of people that I know. I didn't really talk to any Berkshire Hathaway people myself. I did talk to some Rocky Mountain Power people about some of the projects we're working with them individually. I think it was good for them to understand what communities like Park City and Summit County can do to make sustainable energy the future of the country.
And what was their response?
I think we're getting a lot of positive response from them. Yeah, we, like I said, we didn't have specific asks and from them. It was more of an brief information exchange. We had about a half an hour down to Kimball Junction, and Park City had another, I think, half hour. You know, 10 minutes on the bus, and some minutes after that. I guess you'll get to talk to City Council about that tomorrow.
Okay. Let's see. A parental leave discussion. What did the council decide there?
We asked Brian Bellamy. We liked what he proposed, but we wanted to see some more specifics on exactly who would qualify and for parental leave. I think the general feeling amongst the council is to be competitive in the employment market, which is very competitive right now. This is something we should be doing, and it's good for our employees.
Okay. You also met as the Mountain Regional Water Special Service District. Anything there?
Pretty routine stuff. Every year we get a list of liens we're asked to put on the tax rolls for people who haven't paid their water bills. My understanding from them is that it's mostly vacant property that just hasn't paid their water connection fees. And these property owners prefer to get liened, even though it's more expensive. I guess there's some tax benefits to them. I understand. It's a tiny percent of the Mountain Regional budget, and it's less than 1% of their actual connections.
Yeah. Have you hired a new director?
News will be coming about that shortly.
Okay.
We've had extensive conversations, and I believe you'll be hearing something in the not too distant future.
All right. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's about it.
Okay, Glenn, thank you.
You're welcome.
Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as we have reported, the statewide standardized test known as SAGE going away. It's been used since 2013. In the studio to talk about how that's being replaced, I have Andrew Fink. He serves as the technology director for the Park City School District. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So are you now in charge of testing? It seems like it used to be handled by Kathy Einhorn as kind of the curriculum director.
Yeah, actually, prior to this past year, it was handled by Dr. Tim McConnell, who was our HR director and assessment director. And this past year, I took on that role of assessment director from him. And I'm also over technology. So I'm going to put those two pieces together.
Okay. So the fact that SAGE is going away, is that a good thing?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate. The SAGE test itself was a really good test, but there were some complications, I think, in the larger Utah community around it. And also, it was time, you know, the state office generally every 5 years does a new contract. as part of their procurement process. So they went out and did a new one here and wound up going with a different vendor. A nice change here is this time the contract is for 10 years. They have the opportunity to back out if they need to, but that gives us a nice bit of stability as we go forward and learn this new system.
So criticism of SAGE has been that it was too subjective and the questions didn't accurately portray student competencies. How will this new one be different?
Well, the new testing system is actually two completely different systems now. So for students in 3 through 8, there's the new RISE testing system. I expect that the experience for students will be fairly similar. It is still using the same Utah question bank, which was developed here in Utah with a combination of folks down at the state office and Utah teachers. That one does have a few nice changes, though, that I think will make the experience a little better for our students. One of the biggest one is that the SAGE test, if you're aware, was what's called a item responsive. So you'd answer a question, depending on how you did on that question, you'd get a different question depending on that one, which was nice, except that it didn't really allow you to go back if you realized, hey, wait a minute, I need to fix that answer on question 5. The new test is called multi-stage adaptive, where you get roughly half the test. It's 2 stages. So every student gets the first part of the test, and then depending on how you do in that first part, you get a different second part of the test. So it means that within each of those parts, the student can go back before they move on and say, oh, I need to go back and fix question 2, so they can go back and rethink it. And then once they're done, they get their second stage and can go on through there. I think that's going to be a nice thing for our students.
Yeah. Is this also a test that's done at the end of the year?
Yes.
So there's some criticism with that, too. I mean, how is it that it then helps the student if we're...
Well, it's a different sort of a test. So we have during the year, we have all sorts of assessments that go on, and teachers are doing these constantly. You know, that one of the biggest questions we always need to be asking as educators is, did the student learn what we're trying to teach them? So we're doing pieces of that formative work for that all through the year. But it's also good to have a summative look back at, gee, how did we do? And I also like having an external test, like something like the new RISE test, that also keeps us honest to make sure, hey, we're supposed to be teaching to our Utah core standards. So let's have an outside test come in so we can look at that and make sure we're really doing what we need to do. So now for 9th and 10th grade, the test is very different. The state board rules had a different set of requirements for that, for those two grades. So rather than looking at sort of end of course level stuff as we do in 3 through 8, 9 and 10 is really focused on college and career readiness. So it is a very different kind of a test. While it's given at the end of year, it is not an end of course test. So every 9th grader is going to get the same test, essentially. Every 10th grader gets the same test. Very similar to the ACT. So one of the things I think will actually be a real benefit to students with the new, this is called the Utah Aspire, is that it is a great practice towards the ACT. It's a similar sort of test. About half of the questions on it will be from the ACT Aspire test, and half are based on our Utah question bank. So the nice thing there is it will eventually be able to be predictive of ACT. So if a student takes the Utah Aspire, they get a feel for where they would be sitting on that ACT. And it's also a great practice. It's timed. It's the same sort of environment. So when they finally do go to take the ACT, they'll have had a chance to be through that and not have to worry as much about the mechanics of it, which I think would be a real benefit for our students.
Yeah. And then I think there was funding provided by the state then for every 11th grader to take the ACT?
Yes. Yes. And they've been doing that for the past couple of years, which I think is a great opportunity for the students to have a free option to go through that.
All right. There was some concern, my understanding, in keeping the SAGE question bank, as you referred to it. Why is that?
I have not heard any concern about that myself. I think it's a really strong question bank. I mean, the SAGE, the testing like that the SAGE engine uses or a new RISE engine will use, it's different than your standard old multiple choice test. But it's a much better way to get a look at, especially to get deeper into the depth of knowledge on what a student really knows rather than just can they pick it out of a lineup of a few answers.
Okay. And then basically we're testing reading, writing, arithmetic, and science?
Yes. So so for RISE, they'll be tested in their three main areas. So English language arts, math and science. And a slight difference is ELA will include writing, but only in 2 years, just in grades 5 and 8. So a slight difference from before is those scores will be separated. Prior, they were all kind of lumped together. You got a single English language arts score. Now you'll actually have a separate English language arts and writing, in part so that as we look year to year, we can still compare those ELA scores even in the years they don't have writing. Now for Aspire, that is English, reading, math, and science. But again, it's an end of level test, not an end of course test. So it's not you take biology, so you take the biology Aspire. It's no end of year, you take the full test back, very similar to ACT.
Okay. So are the tests all done online, or do we still use the fill in the bubble with the pencil?
All online. It's a real advantage that we have with the resources that this community has dedicated to us, that we actually have, you know, we're 1-to-1 now down to second grade. So we have plenty of technology available to make this go smoothly. And I have a really good tech staff and assessment staff and teachers to make sure this all happens well.
Yeah. And how much time do we spend taking these standardized tests?
Well, you know, we just finished up a test time audit based on some work that the Canyons had done. And we're looking, the average was about 2% of instructional minutes throughout the year, which is where we would hope to be. So it's not a particularly time-intensive thing overall. Now, that doesn't speak to, you know, the month of May, for instance, is very testing intensive, depending on what courses you're in, especially if you're in AP testing. And that's actually something that myself and our statistician will be looking at this year. Now that we have some time data, we're also looking at, what are the actual, you know, test instances a student's sitting down to do? So how does that speak into this issue of testing fatigue and all of that? I'm just trying to get a better handle on it. And we are working on an assessment audit this year. This is kind of the very first run we're doing at this in a little while, just to get a feel for, you know, what we're doing. Do we have any overlap? Or are there any areas that we have a gap that we really don't have the data we need in a spot? Or, we've got three things telling us this one thing. Maybe there's something we could prune out. So
you'll be making that assessment over the school year, or?
Yeah, we're starting this fall. We have some help from one of our consultants just to kind of walk us through the process. And it's a good start. It's going to be an ongoing process. It's going to take us a number of years to really go through it. But I'm really excited to get started on that.
All right. And these tests, are they going to be available in Spanish, or is it all in English?
Yes and no. My remembrance, and I'm going to speak a little broadly here, is that, and I'm fairly certain it was the RISE test, had some ability to be in Spanish for non-ELA subjects, which if you think about it, makes sense if we're looking at trying to assess content knowledge rather than language. On the other side of that is that a lot of that content has to do with students knowing the proper instructional language and having a handle on that. So it's a challenging thing. So I'm excited that we'll have some new options to look at.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about opting out, because that's kind of come into play here in terms of potential funding.
Yes.
Students at this point have been allowed to opt out of the test. And as you mentioned,
yep,
May is such a busy testing month, mm-hmm, that it's just like, you know what, I'm taking advanced level testing. Why do I need to state standardized tests? But will it be required now?
So the state legislator has made it very clear that parents have a right to opt their students out of testing. That's in state code. And we also now have, as we look at our connections with ESSA, the feds have said you need to have 95% participation. So we have two philosophies that have some conflict. And I've had a number of discussions with folks down at the Utah State Board of Education, and they're well aware of this conflict that it puts us into. So what will happen, and this is a new situation compared to previous years. In previous years, if folks opted out, those students were removed from our accountability numbers entirely. You know, so if we had, say, our high school, which has had the last few years about 50% opt out. So you know, if you had 40 of those 50 kids who still 50% and still took it, you'd get 80% proficiency. Sounds great. Now we have to bump that number up to get the full 95%. So we wind up being about that same number of students, we'll be about 42% proficient, because we have to take that we have to get up to 95%, so they include those kids as zeros. That was what came in the new ESSA plan that was just approved in the last week or so.
So what do we need to do then to encourage more participation?
So a couple things I'm hoping. One, especially for 9th and 10th graders, I really think that we have a good case to be made around the Utah Aspire test and how that's directly useful for those students. And as for the RISE test, I still strongly believe that that having that end of year instructional look back at how we're doing is really critical. So you'll be hearing more from myself and from our communications folks starting in the fall as we really work to make a case for folks on this.
Right. And we had heard from Heidi Matthews, president of the Utah Education Association, basically saying that the purpose of the original standardized test was to level the playing field during the civil rights movement. Now we're using them to evaluate teachers and schools. I mean, how do you see that? What this is all about?
So, and I'm always careful with the word evaluate, because when I look at, I want to be able to look at a program. I'll back up a second. So when I look at assessment, we're either looking at an individual student. Have you learned what we need you to learn? Where are your strengths? Where are your weaknesses? So that's part of where any of these tests can help us. The other side is looking at our larger programs. Hey, we've tried some things. Are they working? And as we all know, it's always good to have some outside eyes, which we're having some of these standardized tests, tests that we didn't write. So we're not just being assessed on the things that we think we should know, but hey, this is aligned with the Utah standards that we're supposed to be teaching. It's a really good way to get to look at that. The complication we have is with the number of opt-outs, especially at our secondary schools, we really can't use those tests, to try and figure those larger questions. It's just the stats just don't line up with that number of students not taking the tests.
Is it only Utah schools taking this test, or do we actually have some national comparisons?
Well, the question bank was Utah developed. With the Utah Aspire, now half of that is ACT based, but half of that will also be Utah question banks. So I don't know off the hand how well we'll be able to do any kind of national connections. I know I've heard some discussions around that down the road, but I don't expect to see that right off the bat.
All right. So you're basically ready to go, or do you have several months now before it's the test is given in May?
Well, we have some time, which is good, because as anyone who's ever worked in a school knows, this is one of my busiest times of the year. We're getting ready for everyone coming back, and we've got a very short summer. But you'll start to hear more from us in the fall as we help to explain for our parents and folks what's coming. And I want to make sure everyone really understands how it's going, and our teachers as well, so they're not surprised by what this is, because it is different than we've had in the past.
Okay. You mentioned briefly the one-on-one, that every student has a laptop computer?
Yes.
Are we using now tablets?
We have some in the very lower grades. So we have some in K-1, and then in grades 2 through 4, we have laptop carts. So we have one for every student, but they don't take them home, any of that sort of stuff. And then in grades 5 through 12, we actually assign the student a machine. They start taking them home in 6th grade. So they keep them for 4 years. Actually, it's those machines that we're then able to pass down at those lower grades. The Apple laptops we've been using are really, really sturdy machines. They seem to go for, we get 7 or 8 years out of them. And then we have iPads kind of scattered about for specific things.
And is that a decision then by the district to use kind of the Apple product as opposed to the...
Yeah, when we first started this, it's almost 10 years ago when we started going on the one-to-one route. We looked at a variety of devices, and at the time, given that we had been an Apple district before that, so we're like, oh well, this seems good, and we kind of we put a committee together with some teachers and some parents, and iPads had just come out, so we looked at all that and said, well, iPads really can't do what we need them to do at this time, and we're getting ready to start to look at those devices again, because I'm having more teachers coming, hey, gee, an iPad might be a better situation here, so we're looking at the range over the next year or two to kind of see what that's going on.
Yeah, I just see some districts in California go into like Chromebooks and stuff, mm-hmm. right? So that they've got a computer and a tablet. Yeah.
Chromebooks are interesting. They are much less expensive and they have a much shorter lifespan. Whereas, the Mac machines are more expensive, but we can repair them in-house. And I said, we're getting, 4 years with a student and then 3 more years at the elementary school. And then, frankly, other school districts then take our leftover machines once they've done 7 years and are using them for more years.
Okay. All right, Andrew, I'm out of time, but thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Andrew Frink is the Director of Technology for the Park City School District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. 8:42 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, Mary Emmy Gardner has been appointed to serve as CEO for Holy Cross Ministries of Utah. She joins me now in the studio along with Patricia Sanders, Director of Development and Communications for Holy Cross Ministries. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Emmy, let's start with you and just talk a little bit about yourself and why you wanted the position.
Sure. So I actually have a long history with Holy Cross. And so for me, it became like coming home again. I actually came out to Utah because I was a Holy Cross associate, went to St. Mary's College in South Bend, Indiana, which is also another ministry run by the Holy Cross Sisters. And so did work at Catholic Community Services for several years and then went on to graduate school and then a healthcare career for 30 years with Intermountain Healthcare. And when I retired in December to help care for my mother, I thought that was kind of the end of working and just really spending time with family. And then when this opportunity came up, it just felt right. It just to be able to, in a huge way, give back to the sisters for what has become a wonderful life for me here in Utah, because I'm not a native. I grew up in Chicago. And so it's just an amazing opportunity. And this is day two for me. And I can't even just begin to tell you how welcoming and how passionate and how dedicated the staff are. And so, yeah.
Well, give us a little bit about the background about the nonprofit. I mean, I think it was originally started by nuns serving in what was known as Holy Cross Hospital, now Salt Lake Regional Hospital.
Right, right. And those were the sisters that sponsored me when I was a Holy Cross associate and working in the refugee resettlement program. And right, so there was Holy Cross Hospital. And as I understand it, once, you know, they sold the hospital and they also had a school, St. Mary's School, for a while, too. And so the sisters have been very wise fiscal stewards of their resources and then, again, wanted to keep that money here in Utah and wanted to look at how they could serve the needs of vulnerable populations in the community and really meet that niche where other folks aren't, and then to partner with folks in the community to be able to then sustain those kind of initiatives. And so our board chair uses a wonderful phrase, and I absolutely love it, that the Sisters of the Holy Cross are instigators of good. And how can you not want to work in an organization like that?
Now, Holy Cross Ministries has a big presence here in Park City. Why is that?
You know, I'm going to have Patricia answer that one just because she's got a little more history in that. Yeah.
Our history in Park City has been longstanding. A big piece of that was looking at the landscape, gosh, nearly 20 years ago with early childhood education and kind of assessing, really at the instigation of Sister Marianne Pajakowski, what needs were going unmet and how could we help fill those gaps. And one of them was preschool education for low-income families up here in Park City. So we began that program, and it's been running strong since.
Okay. And now that the public schools are offering a preschool, has that taken away from your students?
It's definitely meant a lot of changes, which we view as a good thing. It's been an adaptation of, initially we were serving five-year-olds, and when the full-day kindergarten programs became available, we were delighted because that meant the need had been met. So the shift since then really has been down towards the 0-3 population. We've worked in great partnership with PC Tots and the part-day programming through the district for those younger kids. But the biggest expansion on that end has been offering a Parents as Teachers program, which is a national evidence-based home visiting program for parents of 0-3-year-olds. And to date, Holy Cross Ministries is the only certified organization offering that up here in Summit County.
So is this a religious-based preschool?
It's not, no. So the Parents as Teachers is part of an evidence-based national model that's offered across the world, and it's based in early childhood development and really looking at those social and emotional development milestones to help children reach their fullest potential. So part of that includes a hearing screening to ensure that there aren't any red flags from a health perspective, where at that point we would refer out to the People's Health Clinic or a specialist, you know, who can take on those issues. But a lot of it is just working in collaboration with the parents to help them be their child's first and best teacher.
All right. You're also trying to hire a bilingual person to help run that program?
Yes. Yeah. So right now we have the coordinator of our school readiness program has been overseeing and supervising our one parent educator who actually goes into the homes. And part of our strategic planning conversations have been to expand that program. As I said, Holy Cross Ministries is the only one offering it here in Summit County. And we know there are a lot more babies out there that we can't reach with just one person. So the first step in that is to have a full-time coordinator who can really take this program and run with it.
Now, Holy Cross Ministries was one of the finalists for the Women's Giving Fund grant this year. What would you have used that money for if you had been awarded
it? Sure. Yeah. Well, first, you know, I have to say thank you to the Park City Community Foundation and Women's Giving Fund. The fact that this just remarkable group of women have chosen to invest in and really highlight programs for women and children in Summit County is remarkable to me. I'm thrilled that that's something this town offers and really emphasizes because we know how important that is. The proposal that Holy Cross had submitted for this grant application was to really develop and implement an evidence-based prenatal curriculum in partnership with the People's Health Clinic, where we have a promotora or a community health worker stationed. One of the needs, you know, in conversations with Beth Armstrong that had come up was we really need to expand and enhance the curriculum and the education that we offer to moms who are coming in, especially young first-time moms, to make that available. So the proposal was to develop and implement that evidence-based prenatal curriculum here.
And you say that it's all about what you call vulnerable communities. I mean, what does that look like? I mean, is it race? Is it income? What do you base that vulnerability
sure.
on?
Truthfully, anyone who comes through our doors is going to get served. If they're looking for services or asking for help, no one gets turned away. In our line of work, it often means someone who doesn't have health insurance, who's making minimum wage and having a hard time making ends meet. But really, it's anyone who needs some help.
All right. So will you still run with this prenatal program or just find the money somewhere else?
Sure. So we definitely need to go back to the drawing board and look and see where those dollars will come from. But our hope is to move forward with it because we know it's needed. We know it's important, and we want to see that happen.
All right. And when we talk about prenatal, we talk about, be caring, being pregnant, right? And so what's the education there? I mean, it's, right, it's eat well, don't smoke, don't drink, and take your vitamins. Huh?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of it is breaking down cultural barriers and helping explain during the time of the pregnancy what is it that these young women can be doing to help ensure their health during the pregnancy, but also their baby's health once they're born. Another component of that is helping to create a follow-up network. We know postpartum depression is prevalent, and there isn't really anything right now built in to help support those moms if that's something they face after the baby's born.
Okay, how many people do you help on
an annual basis? Holy Cross serves around 4,000 individuals each year.
And that's statewide?
It is, yes.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to Park City, do you have other kind of groups outside of the Salt Lake Valley?
Sure. Our other primary hub is in Salt Lake County. But truthfully, with the services we offer, there are only so many other organizations statewide that have those available. So we could see individuals from anywhere coming into that Salt Lake office.
Okay. And just another minute here. You have conducted a study, is my understanding, on early childhood education here in Park City and whether or not kids from your preschool program actually have succeeded academically once they've got into the school district. What did you find briefly?
Yeah, no, it's been a really remarkable study. Over the past 2 years, we've conducted a longitudinal study of children who participated in Holy Cross Ministries preschool program, but also families from the same demographic who didn't participate in preschool or maybe went to a preschool, but it wasn't Holy Cross Ministries school readiness program. So the idea was to follow up with these children now that they're in third, fourth, fifth grade and see how are they doing now, what worked, what didn't work, you know, what is it that we need to really dial in on. And the immediate result of the study was very promising, that going into kindergarten, these children were doing fantastic academically and have continued to sustain some of those outcomes over time. What it did tell us is that, as we know, there's still a gap between low-income students and their more affluent peers, and so we're working to help strengthen the programs and look at it from some different angles to see what more can we be doing to help expand those outcomes.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Patricia Sanders, Emmy Gardner, thanks for your time and congratulations on the new job.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Well, there is only one sport in the Winter Olympic Games not open to both genders. That's Nordic Combined, the sport that combines ski jumping with cross-country skiing. The International Olympic Committee has ruled that women's Nordic Combined will not be included in the 2022 Olympic Games. In the studio to discuss that, I have the executive director of USA Nordic, Billy DeMong, along with Tara Garrity-Motes. She's one of the women who is impacted by that decision. Good morning, guys.
Hey, morning. Thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, so was this a recent decision then, Billy?
Yeah, so last week the IOC had their big meeting, and you know there was a lot of hype around gender equality and the addition of new disciplines in sports. I know team aerials and big air were added, as well as monobob for women. And you know, really, it was focused on how they're approaching gender equality. There's 45% of the medal events now are for women, but you know. One of the things that was added is mixed team ski jumping, which is a two men and two women event, which is great. And we're really excited about the further development of women's ski jumping this year. And the international calendar will also add a lot of women's big hill events. So there's a lot of development on that side. But, you know, with one of the original Olympic disciplines, Nordic combined skiing, we're really disappointed with this decision, especially given the international community has a lot of solidarity on this. We've been meeting now for 5 years. We produced a strategic plan at the FIS level. All the countries have bought in, and we're 1 year ahead of that plan with the hopes of getting the women into the games in 2022. And Tara, I've known since she was probably 8 or 9 years old. She's been really waiting for the sport to catch up to her for almost two decades. And she's a very strong competitor and a great athlete, but. You know, at some point, you know, she's been through biathlon. She's been a women's ski jumping competitor at the world championship level. She really wants to get her teeth into, you know, this highest level Nordic combined opportunity. And so it's hard to know that now we're potentially another 7-8 years away from that opportunity.
So you're pretty disappointed, I'm guessing, Tara. Does that mean that you kind of refocus your efforts somewhere else?
Yeah, I was very disappointed when I heard the IOC was not going to let women's Nordic combine in the Olympics. It's been a childhood dream of mine. That being said, I was really happy, you know, for women's ski jumping that we were able to get another event. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually allow any more women's ski jumpers to go to the games because it's only two women's ski jumpers in that event. I did know that this was a possible decision of the IOCs. I knew it was sort of a flip of a coin. So I was disappointed, but I'm really excited about the fact we have world championships coming up in 2021 for women's Nordic combined. We have a World Cup in 2022 or 2020-2019 season. And this year we'll have a Continental Cup level of competition, as well as the first ever junior world championships for the younger girls who are doing Nordic combined.
Okay, so you'll be competing. I mean, those are years off, but in terms of now, I mean, do you shift your focus exclusively to ski jumping or cross-country skiing? Or
Actually, that's a subject we had a team-wide meeting about this morning, so we're all trying to work together and find the best solution for me. I will be trying to make the 2019 World Championship team for ski jumping, and also compete in as many Nordic combined international events that I can and help promote the sport, help be an ambassador, help make it look exciting for young women getting into the sport.
So, Billy, what were the grounds for not including Nordic combined?
You know, I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, I think it's very political with the number of sports that they did add. There's definitely also a pursuit of balance in the terms of and sustainability, the number of events in each quad. So with adding that many new disciplines and new sports, I think Nordic combined just potentially isn't politically strong enough to usurp, you know, a bid for another discipline. I do think going forward with the solidarity amongst all the countries, I know Germany was very disappointed by this decision, Norway, everybody's been investing in trying to build this sport. And, you know, I think going forward, we will see this come into the games. And it's just that, you know, we've worked hard as an international community of Nordic combined skiers, men and women, to try to get ahead of this schedule to make it possible for 2022. So the immediate reaction for sure is disappointment.
So what happens, what needs to happen to get it included in the 2026 games?
Well, not that it's always a hard rule, but one of the biggest things we've heard in the past when disciplines like women's ski jumping originally didn't make it into the games in 2010 is that it hasn't had a world championships. So we have world championships on the calendar for 2021. So that will be the last real argument to not have it. I do know that, you know, not having had an official World Junior Championships, but an unofficial one last year as a test event, we did have great participation. We had 14 nations and 36 athletes, which I think actually beat everybody's expectations. So, you know, I think the good thing is because everybody is so focused on developing the sport, it's happening rapidly. I think the real danger here, though, is for an athlete like Tara is going forward, you know, she can't really focus on Nordic Combined because there's not a World Cup level with prize money and everything else. You know, she still can't go to the World Championships this year or next year. So she still has to, you know, keep her head in ski jumping. And then, you know, we don't want to lose people while we, you know, try to get to this highest level. But my hope is that because FIS Nordic Combined is so focused on this as a priority, that by 2022, 2023, we'll have a full World Cup tour. And I know one of the things that's been really excellent about the development of the sport so far is that with the Continental Cup tour, with women's, we're having them always with World Cup or Continental Cup men's events. And that's a priority from the international race director, Lasse Ottesen, who used to be the U.S. Nordic Combined head coach, that he will continue that to make sure that the teams also don't need to stand up a huge new staff right out of the gate before we're all ready.
Okay, I just got a minute left, though. I wanted you to give some time to talk about what you've got happening at the Utah Olympic Park in Soldier Hollow this week. It's
absolutely
the national championships.
Yep, we've got national championships together with our partners over at U.S. Ski and Snowboard. Friday morning, we're going to kick it off with the 20th annual Yndro Meyer Springer Tournée on the K90 meter. Saturday morning is the K90 National Championships, followed by the Nordic Combined race down at Soldier Hollow in the afternoon. And then Sunday we have the Large Hill Ski Jumping Championships, which all events will start at about 9 a.m. Not about. They'll start at 9 a.m. and go till about 11. Nordic Combined will be at about 4 o'clock on Saturday. And you can find the schedule on usanordic.org.
Okay. You'll be competing then, Tara?
I will be competing. Okay.
Great. Well, good luck to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now at 9 o'clock.